Hello and welcome to another instalment of CricViz at the World Cup. Today we'll be discussing the key analytical points from the third round of matches here in India as the table begins to take shape. This round has seen India extend their dominance over Pakistan in World Cups with a comfortable win in Ahmedabad, an upset for the ages as England faltered again against Afghanistan in Delhi, and Australia finally getting off the mark with a win over Sri Lanka in Lucknow. I'm Patrick Noon alongside Ben Jones, our head of insight. We're in Pune ahead of India v Bangladesh on Thursday, while James Norton Brown, our head data scientist, joins us from back in London. Now, only really one place to start, which is the biggest game of the tournament so far, probably the biggest game of the tournament, full stop, India against Pakistan. Bit of an anticlimax from a neutral's point of view. India won't care, of course. They made it 8 wins from 8 against Pakistan in World Cups. Pakistan laid a solid platform. They got to 155 for two, but then collapsed with 8 wickets for 36 to only post 191. India chased that down in 30.3 overs. Rohit again in the runs with 86 off 63. Shreyas got a 50 as well. While before that, Bumrah had taken 2 for 19 off 7. Come to you first, Ben. That game looked like it was bubbling up nicely before Babar's dismissal. What did you make of that collapse?
It was, as you mentioned, a slightly frustrating day for the neutral because these games get, hyped to all hell, and everyone gets very excited. And even in, in the relatively kind of sanitized confines of broadcast, you can't help but like get really pumped up for it. And last year, the MCG game, Kohli's shot, that finish, it was one of the great atmospheres and one of the great games. That was one of the few times that it's ever going to live up to the excitement that's built ahead of time. This wasn't really like that. The atmosphere obviously was really different. There were clearly a huge number of people there, over 100,000, but it was a different kind of atmosphere because it was obviously all Indian fans. It was an odd experience watching a game like that where it's obviously all entirely supporting one side in terms of the crowd. It just creates a slightly strange environment. I think the start of the game kind of contributed to that in terms of obviously the Pakistan lose a couple of wickets and they almost get the fuss out of the way early and get to the real story of Babar and Rizwan batting together. And during that time, they get Pakistan to 155 for two, like you mentioned. But it was so calm and serene. It was exactly what Pakistan wanted to be doing. They'd seen off the early Bumrah spell just about. They'd kind of got through to a stage where they were going to build some pressure on the Indian attack. And I think during that phase, they only played 12.5% false shots, which is less than the average you see in Test cricket, let alone in white ball cricket. And they were gradually starting to stretch their legs, playing a few more shots against the spinners particularly. They were just growing into it. And the ball before the wicket of Babar Azam, bowled by Mohammad Siraj, Pakistan's win viz touched 49%. So it was almost like we'd got to this point where the game was in the balance. It's fully there for a proper neutral favoured contest. And then Siraj bowls that lovely delivery to the kind of just clips Babar's stumps, and then from there it was a mess. There was poor shot selection for Pakistan's middle order. There was some fantastic bowling, particularly from Bumrah, but also from the spinners. Kuldeep Yadav, I thought, fantastically, as did Ravindra Jadeja. And it suddenly felt like all the air went out of the contest within about 20 minutes, and from then on it was a bit of a procession.
Yeah, definitely. I think Pakistan will obviously be disappointed with how it went, but you shouldn't take anything away from India, particularly as you say, those bowlers bowled well. Particularly Bumrah, I thought he's been excellent since start of the competition. 8 wickets in his first 3 games. James, what have you made of his return from injury? It's great to see him back, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's always a special moment in sport when sort of the stage is set for someone for a competition and they sort of deliver immediately. He's been the best bowler in the competition, the best player in the tournament so far, and sort of looks like if he's in this form, then it's going to be very difficult for India to not go on and win this competition. He is the player that India have sort of been looking for in white ball cricket for a long time. He's sort of the cornerstone of that Mumbai Indians dynasty in the IPL. He is just absolutely amazing. He's the best all-round bowler in the world, and he's sort of stepping up to the plate in a home World Cup, and it's brilliant to see, to be honest. It's just the amount of skill, that sort of, what was it, 130 kilometers an hour off spinner to get Rizwan, and then the like reverse swing away swinger to get Shadab Khan. Just the same bowler to be able to do both of those things in the space of a spell is just absolutely remarkable. He's been just unbelievable. We sort of talked at the start of the tournament about how if he performs well and if Kuldeep bowls well, then India are going to be really difficult to beat at home. It sort of almost feels like Bumrah knows that and he's sort of stepping up to the plate. And it just looks like that he's going to win the competition. So I think if just by some of the stats at the moment, he's got sort of the lowest false shot percentage against him of any bowler in the competition. So teams aren't attacking him at all. We sort of saw that in the power play. Siraj was a bit off in the power play. But Bumrah just being consistently on his line leg, just sort of made sure that Pakistan didn't get away there. The interesting thing is he's got five wickets against people playing defensive and rotating shots against him. So in ODI cricket, that's very rare. Normally, when you decide not to attack a bowler, you can sort of avoid wickets. That doesn't seem to be the case against Bumrah. I sort of wonder whether teams are going to sort of realise that and try to start attacking him a bit more. His sort of bowling strike rate, so the number of balls per dismissal, is the same, no matter whether you attack him or if you defend him. So it sort of feels like you may as well just sort of the bass ball type approach, but in ODI cricket, you sort of can't. He's going to get you out, so you may as well have a go. I sort of wonder whether that's going to be something we see going forward, because he's just been peerless at the moment. And then talking about, so we talked about Kuldeep as well. I think India's spinners have also just been the best in the competition. They've got the best average in the competition and the best economy rate. They're going under 4 runs and over. And you contrast that with Pakistan, who've been the second worst spin attack in the competition. Only Netherlands have the worst average and only Netherlands have the worst economy rate. So just for both these teams, obviously Bumrah's been amazing, but the spin attacks have really been crucial to both these bowling attacks. And if India's continue to be brilliant, obviously they have played on probably some of the more spin-friendly pitches so far. But if that continues for India, then they're going to be very difficult to beat. And Pakistan are going to really struggle if their spin attack doesn't come in good. Just an interesting little nugget is that the team that's bowled the best spin, so the best bowling spin impact, has won every single game in this World Cup so far. So that's something to look at for moving forward as well.
Yeah, and if anything, you'd expect that to be even more pronounced as the pitches maybe get tighter and more used and so on. So after they'd done all the bowling, they obviously came out to bat, and Rohit, again, we saw him get 100 against Afghanistan, followed that up with 86 off 63 balls, including 6 fours and 6 sixes. Ben, you were purring about the kind of form he's in at the moment. What did you make of that?
He's just seeing it like a beach ball, isn't it? It's just so nice. I think particularly in cricket, you see it because you get these discrete units of chances to perform in a way that you don't necessarily in other team sports. But like when a player is just so in it, every time they go out, it looks like they're about to do something incredibly special. And that is what we saw in Ahmedabad with Rohit on whatever it was, Saturday night. I think there was any number of brilliant shots to pick from. But I think the over against Harris Rife, where he picks one up, you know, off his nose, really, and hooks him for six in a very Rohitian way. But then also goes inside out for over cover six off a kind of wide full ball. It wasn't the best ball, but to get it to where he did was remarkable. And it kind of summed up that the whole thing that Rohit has got, which is just this like effortless power, because, you know, he's a big guy, he's a strong bloke, but he's also got this amazing timing that just kind of the ball just pings off the bat. And I thought it was a really interesting demonstration, or it has been an interesting demonstration in this World Cup, of kind of what Rohit has done to his own game and what he's done to the Indian side as a result since he's become captain. Since the start of last year when he takes the armband, his intent has gone through the roof. He's become a much, much more aggressive batter, and he was hardly working from a kind of conservative base. He just is taking on all kinds of bowling consistently all the way through the innings. His attacking shot percentage against pace, against spin, in power play one, it's just so much higher than the rest of his career. And it's kind of dragging guys up with him. Like KL is suddenly playing with greater intent. So is Virat. You're seeing a side almost get behind the idea of this like slight revolution. It's a quiet revolution, and it's in the sense that, you know, it's not kind of pinned with baseball or anything like this. There's no kind of labeling of it. They've just kind of gone out and shown that they are going to play with more intent. I think what's going to be really fascinating for the rest of this tournament is that India are playing with more aggression and more intent, and they have done for the last 18 months. But that was what happened before the 2022 T20 World Cup, where we saw them start to play, you know, a more kind of, use the phrase, modern brand of T20 cricket. And they played expressively. But then it got to the World Cup and they didn't carry that through. They were timid. They scored slower than anyone else in the power play apart from the UAE. And they obviously have that horrible display against England in the semi-final in Adelaide. So what we're going to see in the next few weeks is either kind of, it's basically proof of, are India fully bought into this? When it comes to the crunch, not when you're chasing, you know, sod all against Pakistan in a group game. When it actually gets to a knockout game, when you've been stuck into bat against a good side, are you going to play with that intent? At the moment, all the signs suggest yes, but it's fascinating to see whether or not it will
survive that kind of cauldron of pressure that comes with knockout cricket.
Absolutely. Next up for them is Bangladesh here in Pune on Thursday. For Pakistan, they have what looks like a huge game now against Australia in Bangalore on Friday. We'll preview that in a sec, but before then, we'll look at their next opponents in yesterday's match, Australia against Sri Lanka in Lucknow. Sri Lanka made a good start here. They put on 125 for the opening partnership. Nisanka with 61, Pereira 78, but then they lost 10 wickets for 84 runs. Similar kind of story to what happened to Pakistan in the game we just mentioned. Asalanka's 25 was the only other double-figure score after the openers. Zampa returned to form. He took 4 for 47, and then they made light work of the chase with 50s for Marsh and Inglis, while Max Lundstein has had some fun at the end to get them over the line and a fairly comfortable 5-wicket win. James, that looked like it was, again, it was similar to the India-Pakistan game. It looked like it was bubbling away nicely with that good start, but the collapse was a bit concerning for Sri Lanka, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think sort of a trend of the competition overall, but Sri Lanka just got into a winning position, really. I think they misjudged the pitch a bit. I'm not quite sure, but I think looking at it from the whole context of the game, 300 would have been a very, very competitive total. And they were sort of, you know, well over a run of ball at the sort of 20-over mark. And they could have, it sort of felt like they could have just sort of milled it around, got to 280, got to 300, and then really, really had a go at them. But instead, you know, all the batters that had been in form, Mendes, Sawatkrama, just sort of didn't quite fire today. So sort of the players who hadn't been firing in the previous game went, and then the middle order just sort of faltered. But it's an interesting trend of the competition overall. So you hear in ODI cricket, you sort of double your score after 30 is sort of the truism. It's not quite true. It's more like 28 overs through the last 5 years. But in this World Cup, actually, it's actually 24 overs. So teams aren't doubling their total in the second half of the innings, which is pretty unusual. That's very rare for any sort of group of ODI games. So it's something to look out for. There's been quite a lot of collapses. Teams have gone very hard in the early middle overs, sort of trying to attack while four fielders are out against spin. So that then leads to sort of you get more runs in that 10 to 20, 20 to 30 over phase, but you sort of don't have the wickets left in the tank at the death. And I think it was another very interesting example of that in this game. And it's probably a trend to look out for as the competition goes on as well.
Yeah, interesting. We mentioned Zampa on the last pod as well, how he'd been struggling his first couple of games. This was a real return to form. 4 for 47, a couple of lovely googlies in there to sort of mop up the tail. Ben, what do you think he did differently in this match as compared to the previous two where he'd struggled?
Yeah, I think it was a change of approach that really did, you know, bring him the success. I think Zampa is a really, really talented bowler. But I think part of the reason why he's had such success in the Aussie side is that he's very good at bowling in Australian conditions in terms of adapting. You know, leg spin's very difficult art over there. You know, it's been talked about in the context of Shane Warne, obviously, but the fact that Zampa has basically been Australia's, you know, first choice leg spinner for an awful long time in white ball cricket shows that he knows how to work in very bouncy conditions. In Indian conditions, which obviously vary hugely, as we've spoken about, you almost have to adapt on the hoof to every ground. Sometimes the bounce is going to be significant. Sometimes it's going to be slow and low, like we've seen in a couple of the World Cup games so far. What he did in this game particularly was really target the stumps. 44% of his deliveries were going to hit the stumps. That's the second highest for any match in his very, very considerable ODI career. Now, I think partly that was because he did bowl a lot of googlies, you know, turning back into the stumps. So I think he was trying to bring that into play. But it was almost like a simplified version of what white ball leg spin can be. Sometimes you can get a bit too obsessed with T20 approach of, you know, bang it in short of a length, quick, fire it through, Rashid Khan style. But Zampa is more complicated than that. He's not just that bowler. He bowled 4 or 5 Ks slower than he did in the previous game against South Africa. And I think 3 Ks slower than he did against India. So he was giving it more flight, but still keeping that like essence of bring stumps into play, keep things relevant, LBW and bold words. And I think that to get the wicket of Kusal Mendes, Sawatkrama, and a couple of others towards the end of the innings as well, it just showed that he kind of took on the mantle of being Australia's strike bowler in a way that he really hasn't so far in the World Cup. I'm a big fan of Zampa, and I really hope he kind of continues to grow into the comp. It was a really, really impressive display.
Yeah, and I think as well, it's been interesting the way that they've used Maxwell. I think that, you know, they've gone with this sort of batting-heavy approach. Maxwell's bowled more than we're probably expecting. And then yesterday was quite a nice vindication of that sort of batting heavy tactic. You know, Sri Lanka had 5 down Still a few runs left to get, and that, you know, if you had a sort of less proficient batter than Stoinis coming in at that time, that could have been a bit of a wobble. But as it was, he just comes in and blazes 20 off 10 and gets over the line easily. James, what have you made of that approach? Do you think that it is going to work? Do you think that this finally is vindication for it, and that they should stick with it?
Yeah, 100%. I think if you'd asked the Australian coaches before the game who they wanted to score runs, I think they'd have said Maxwell, Stoinis, and Marsh. I think the three of them scoring runs sort of vindicates that. Pick a couple of all-rounders and fill the fifth bowling spot that way approach. I think it's not just that Stoinis gave them security, he also gave them a pretty significant, you know, net run rate boost at the end there. He didn't come into seven and sort of just get 20 or 40 balls to see him over line. He got it done in two overs. It was a very impressive effort. But yeah, I think Maxwell's bowling has really been the key vindication for them so far. He's been their best bowler, which, given he's in the side with Zampa, Hazelwood, Cummins and Stark, is absolutely remarkable. He's been the bowler that other teams have attacked the least in Australia's attack. He has the lowest attack rating against of any bowler in their attack, which is very unusual, very surprising. I don't think anyone would predict that. We sort of talked before the competition about the way to target Australia is to get after that fifth bowler and really try to attack them. And instead, they're sort of seeing off Maxwell almost to try to attack Stark. So I think it's a very interesting thing to think that Australia have played on quite a few turning pitches. They obviously go to Bangalore next, which I think we'll talk about in a minute. So it'll be very interesting to see if that continues. Obviously, it's his home venue for the IPL, so he does know how to bowl at the venue. But if Maxwell can get through sort of 5-6 overs every game, it really does open up that batting-heavy approach. Stoinis obviously can bowl more than he has as well. I think it's a real vindication. I think it was a very nice game for their plan, and hopefully adds a bit of clarity to them going forward.
Yeah, you mentioned that Bangalore game. We'll have a look at that now. Australia-Pakistan in Bangalore on Friday night. That's going to be a pretty crucial game, you'd have to say. Obviously, we haven't seen any games in Bangalore yet. We don't quite know how the pitch plays, but based on how it usually goes in the IPL, it's usually quite a high-scoring venue. Ben, do you think that Pakistan are going to have the batting power to post a score that they might have to win the game there?
I think there can sometimes be a misconception about the Chinnaswamy in terms of how it plays. I think it does still reward quite classic, like, you know, long format technical players, because it is small and it is true and you can go quite hard in a relatively orthodox way and still get really good value for your shots. I don't think you necessarily need to kind of be a hitter in the T20 mold to score quickly. So in some ways, I think there's almost an opportunity for Pakistan to see the limits of what they can do, to really stretch their legs and be like, right, if we just put our foot down a little bit more on the accelerator, can we stick 330, 340 on the board? And if so, is that going to be enough? I think with their bowling attack, if their spin can step up, as James said, then it will be. I think what is particularly interesting is how they go in managing the classic issue of spin getting pelted at Chinnaswamy. Do they rebalance around the idea of taking out one of the all-rounders, either Shadab or Mohammad Nawaz, and maybe just trying to get an extra seamer in there, Mohammad Wasim Jr. being the obvious example, and then just trying to make sure they've got four proper seamers in the side so they don't have to get through too much spin in a World Cup where those guys have already been out of form. You throw them to the lines a little bit if you stick them at the Chinnaswamy against a rampant Australian batting lineup. I think that's probably the main selection issue. From the batting perspective, I think that it's not quite the concern that it could be painted as.
Yeah, 100%. I think the main selection issue for Pakistan is going to be around that Nawaz spot. They could go two leg spinners, they could go four seamers. There's a lot of different options for them there. I think Nawaz has bowled poorly. He's a good matchup for this Australia lineup. They have struggled with slow left arm spin. But as we've sort of seen with RCB and sort of Shahbaz Ahmed and his slow left arm spin at RCB, part time slow left arm is a really struggle. And sort of having them in your team is a real issue, particularly given that their sixth bowler is an off spinner. And I can't imagine you're getting many overs from Iftikhar against this Australia team in Bangalore. So I think if I was them, I'd be pretty worried about my spin allocations. Getting through 20 overs of spin, given the lack of quality in their spinners, I think is going to be a struggle. So I wouldn't be surprised for them to go Wasim Jr. over Nawaz, even if that seems slightly counterintuitive, given Australia's weakness against slow left arm. But I think it could be a venue play.
And Ben, do you think Australia will make any changes? Obviously, Travis Head's still around, not yet fit, but if he is fit, who does he come in for? They might have to do a bit of rejigging with the order or the balance of the team again. Like, how do you see it going?
Yeah, I think we all know that Australia have made no secret of how much they want Travis Head in the team. You know, the fact that they've kept him in the squad when he's been injured, I think the soonest he is available, he will be into the side. Like you say, the debate is really who does he come in for? I think that Marnus Labuschagne has had a really decent World Cup in the context of Australia's slight struggles. But he is probably the guy who's made the, you know, it's kind of last in, first out policy. And I do think that on the higher scoring grounds, as you spoke about Pakistan, you can score quickly if you are an orthodox batter, but I don't think Marnus is quite that player. I think you do want to make sure you've got power if you're Australia and you're looking at these guys. Basically, you're talking about Stoinis versus Marnus as like the option to bring Head in. I think Stoinis on that ground against this Pakistan attack is a far more kind of concerning prospect if you're looking at it from a Pakistan point of view. I think also as well, it's worth saying that, you know, there might have been a tendency to look at it and think, well, you know, Mitch Marsh at the top of the order, let's leave him and give him an extra game. His record at the Chinnaswamy is not great in T20 cricket in the IPL. The average is just under 30, but scores pretty slowly, which is, I think he's striking about 110, which when you're talking about a ground like Bangalore, it's not really anything to write home about. So I think they will be keen to get Head in, and as a result, I think they'll probably make quite a ruthless call on Marnus, and I do think it's the right one.
Good stuff. Okay, elsewhere this week on Sunday night, we saw one of the upsets of the tournament, maybe the upset, one of the upsets of all tournaments, as Afghanistan beat England by 69 runs in Delhi. The underdogs got off to a bit of a flyer with the partnership of 114. Gerber's played nicely for his 80. Chris Woke struggled again, going for 0-41 from his four overs. And then Harry Brook was the only innings when in England's response above 32. He got 66 or 61, played quite nicely, but it wasn't enough as Afghanistan pulled it off. Ben, how big an upset was this? I've seen some people say it's the biggest upset ever, some people pushing back on that. Where do you place it?
Yeah, I think I might have tweeted that from the midst of the sports bar that we were watching it in Pune, and I think I deleted it relatively swiftly because I do think there are far, far more better contenders. But I do think that people are almost reluctant to kind of go too big on what a great upset this was, or what a significant upset this was, partly because of how far Afghanistan have come in the last 4 years. The reason why I think we're talking about it is because it was in 2019, they didn't win a game. And England won the tournament. And 4 years later, we're looking at them not just beating England, but absolutely thrashing them in a way that I don't think we've seen England lose a significant ODI match in quite a long time. I think there are contenders in terms of the biggest upset debate, associates who've beaten bad England sides and bad four-member nations. There are lots of examples of that. You know, Ireland beating England being probably the most the kind of classic example. But what was particularly, I think, interesting is this is a full-strength England side that is not doing particularly well in this World Cup, but is an excellent ODI unit. And Afghanistan just rolled them. They became the main character. This wasn't about something happening to England. It was Afghanistan making it happen at them. They were in control. You know, the Gerber's innings was incredible. It had a sense of, like, the narrative that it wasn't just a freak out of nowhere like Kevin O'Brien just having the day of his life. It was, we are really good cricketers. We have come a long way in 4 years and we are beating the world champions and we are beasting. I thought it was a fantastic performance and a brilliant game. And it was slightly concerning from an England perspective, but in the round, as we said in the last podcast, that we wanted to see a bit of a flame under the World Cup and get it moving. This was exactly what we needed.
Yeah, definitely. I think Gerber's innings typified that. He's a fun player, isn't he, James? What did you make of this innings? This was one of his most significant contributions in an Afghanistan shirt, you'd have to say.
Yeah, absolutely. He's probably one of the best young batters around at the moment. I can't think of too many others that even compete, particularly in the white ball format. He's got all the different gears. And I think that's something he's developed to his game throughout the competition, something we sort of talked about at the start. He's sort of got the ability to sort of hang in there and score those sort of slightly slower innings. But this was not that. This was sort of your back to two years ago, Gerber's just go out and absolutely hammer everything. England didn't, obviously, you know, we'll probably talk about England's power play bowling, and they weren't brilliant, but they weren't bad either. They hit a good length better than they have in their other two games. The ball didn't do a lot, but Gerber's was hitting them off everything. He was hitting them short, he was hitting them on a good length. He was hitting everything full. He was just going at everything, and everything was working. And it was absolutely remarkable to watch. And to be honest, it was a bit disappointing when he got run out, because it sort of felt like there was nothing that was going to get him out that day. He was just absolutely fabulous. And hopefully a sign of things to come, because if he can be like this for Afghanistan for the next 10 years, then with their bowling attack that they have, I think they could be a very exciting prospect in all white ball formats.
Yeah, he did seem gutted to get out, didn't he? And that reaction has cost him a demerit point, unfortunately for him, but I'm sure he won't mind too much, given how the game played out. You touched on England's bowling. Ben, this has been a bit of an issue, hasn't it? Especially early on. Wokes just doesn't look quite right. Topley had a bit of an injury scare. He did then come back onto bowl, but it's all a bit of a mess at the moment, isn't it?
It is. I don't think anyone coming into this World Cup, even those of us who were predicting that England will get to the final, thought that their bowling is their strong point. But I think what we've traditionally seen with, you know, Morgan's England was the bowling is solid and varied and underpins the batting strength. What we're seeing is that at this point it's creating too many problems. They are conceding over par quite a lot. And we'll come on to the batting problems in a bit. But I do still think, we spoke about it on the last podcast, I think that it's best typified in the way we see Chris Wokes. You know, England as a whole are going at 7.2 in the power play in the first 10 overs this World Cup. And a lot of that is down to how Wokes has performed. Now, his expected average, we spoke about in the last podcast again, it's still really, really poor in this World Cup. I think it's up above 40. It's the worst that he's recorded in any competition or series since 2014. He is very much off it when it comes to line length, pace, swing and seam. He is not the bowler that he can be. We've seen that away from home for a long time, Wokes has always struggled in Test cricket, but I think it almost goes under the radar that it's replicated in ODIs as well. I think he had a really good period in 2017, 2018, where, you know, England were absolutely just zooming through teams and beating everyone, where he, I think, he averaged 28 away from home, or maybe even a touch lower. But since then, 2019 to present, I think he averages 66 away from home with the ball. That is not good enough for your front line opening the bowling bowler. And I think also what we've seen as well is that he was always Mr. Dependable. He was always Mr. Consistent, who you could just rely on to not necessarily run through a side, but he would always deliver consistent, solid returns and you know, set the tempo, to use the cliche. Under Morgan's captaincy, which is 81 games, Wokes went at sevens in his opening spell on six occasions. Just get your head around that a sec. Under Butler, it's already happened five times, and it's happened three times in this World Cup. Basically, Wokes never used to get hit out the attack. It would happen once a year. Now it's happening once every 3 days. That is a real, real concern from England. Rhys Topley's the only England bowler with a positive bowling impact in his comp. Everyone else is struggling. Everyone else is out of nick, out of form, out of fitness. They really, really need to kind of either shuffle the deck, change their plans, or just hope that these are quality players who, over time, over a wider sample size, slip back into their best form. Because at the moment, they don't look like taking wickets, and they don't look like containing opposition batting lineup.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, I don't know, obviously the pitch wasn't the reason England lost, but it was did quite differently to what we'd seen earlier in the comp, where it had been a bit of a road. James, have you got any numbers on exactly how different it was? Because it looked a bit trickier to bat on that occasion.
Yeah, it took 25% more spin than previous pitches in that competition, and was significantly more inconsistent in both its pace and its bounce, as well as taking more movement. It obviously wasn't the reason they lost, but sort of meant that 280 score, which previously in games in Delhi in this competition would be a pretty easy chase, was a bit more difficult. And sort of me and Ben were having a chat on our work group about it at halftime, both of possibly just being slightly near the England fans, but being a little bit nervous about the chase, which a lot of people sort of weren't at the time. But yeah, the pitch just wasn't quite as true as it has been previously in Delhi, and probably something to look out for in future games though.
I think obviously England's batting is an ongoing concern. There's been discussions around whether their intent's been right, whether they've not been going hard enough. According to our numbers, at least, they've been the second most attacking side in the World Cup after South Africa. So on the face of it, there's not necessarily an intent issue. It's more of a kind of an execution issue, I think. That's probably the simplest way of putting it. And there have been individual losses of form, etc. And I don't think anyone's hiding away from that. The one caveat I would put on that, and I'm certainly not hiding behind the idea of good and bad fortune, but England's luck in terms of false shots that have then led to a wicket has been pretty remarkable in this World Cup.
I think Josh Butler's played 6 false shots and has been out 3 times or something ridiculous like that. And as a team, overall, I think 1 in 5 false shots has led to a wicket. You know, false shot being an edge or a miss. That is the lowest ratio, i.e. the unluckiest, the most punished of any series that England have had, or any series or tournament that England have had in the last 10 years. And I think the third worst ever. Basically, this is a level of misfortune of basically you've made an error and now you are out that we've seen in the last 15 years since records began. England are not as bad as they currently look. The problem is that the results start to gather momentum. How do England recover when they are in this hole? If they win all their games, they'll go through. But at the moment, that doesn't look particularly likely.
Indeed. And next up for them is South Africa in Mumbai. We haven't really had a chance to speak much about South Africa at all on this pod. They're currently in action at the time of recording against the Netherlands in a rain-affected game in Dharamsala. Netherlands, I can see, 194/7 with a couple of overs left in that. You'd expect South Africa to come away with a win there, which would make it 3 from 3 for them, although strange things have happened. James, is this a must-win game? Are we in that territory yet for England, or have they still got a bit of wiggle room?
We're not miles off, but not must-win by the definition, but England would go back up to sort of 47% chance of qualification if they win on Saturday, but they drop down to 15% if they lose. So sort of, they're probably allowed one more loss in the competition, potentially 2. So I think, it's pretty close. This early in the competition, England having a 15% chance to qualify if they lose would be right up against it. I think what that will mean in terms of selection is this the time to make those changes? So we've sort of heard about Stokes being almost ready to come back, and I think they even said on the commentary stuff whether, if this was a knockout game, he'd probably play. And I think we are definitely at that point. I think we'll see Stokes in the side this weekend. Who he comes in for, I think, is a very interesting question. Similar to what we said with Australia, I think Brook probably is the person to drop out, just sort of last in, first out sort of mentality. But, given the lack of form of Moeen and Curran, they could look to rebalance and go batting heavy. I just think that would leave them, I think, on more spinning pitches later in the competition. That's something they could look to do, particularly with how well Livingston have bowled. But I think in Mumbai against this Africa team, I think that would be very risky. The other interesting thing is then obviously your Wilkes point. So he's been pretty poor. So has Curran. So whether they change their seam attack, obviously they have Woody on the bench, who's been brilliant in ODI cricket. His numbers are very good for the last couple of years. But Gus Atkinson's a very interesting prospect. South Africa are pretty weak against high pace. Their numbers are, I think, everywhere apart from their opening batters, averages below 35 against high pace. So Gus Atkinson could be a bolter for this game and could be a good option for them, particularly if the pace of the pitch looks pretty, if it's a pretty green pitch, I think it could be an exciting option for them. But it would be pretty risky, obviously, but it could be the time for that risk.
Yeah, conditions will be interesting, I think. Obviously, the last time England played South Africa in Mumbai in an ICC event, it was the famous T20 run chase where England chased down 230. It's generally a pretty high-scoring venue, as we've seen in the IPL. Ben, how do you think it will play? This will obviously be our first look at the ground, but based on recent history, what can we expect?
I'm glad you mentioned that game. It's one of my favourite T20 games ever. I remember watching it in the library at uni and being slightly confused by quite how many runs are being scored in such a short time. I think there is a bit of legacy here of like Mumbai does just create these games that are quite odd in shape because it is just so high scoring and so in favour of pace. And I think we saw that in the recent IPL. Yeah, it was the most high scoring venue. And we also saw a massive chase bias there. We all, the side batting second really did come out on top more, I think, than any other venue. What we've also seen for England's perspective is that recently chases have really not been their thing. They've really struggled to get over the line when they've been set a total. And you almost wonder, do you go with the venue's characteristics if Josh Butler wins the toss, or do you go with what your side's recent form is? I think that's a really interesting little sub-narrative. I think in some ways, the simplicity of the Wankhede as a venue might work in England's favour because it will just simplify their thinking. This is a high-scoring venue that is in favour of pace. It's not Delhi, where we don't really know what it is anymore. The Kotler has suddenly become this thing of like, oh, right, out of nowhere, it's the Chinnaswamy now, when it used to be the Chapars. you know, the Chennai ground. Now we've started to see, you know, England trying to second guess themselves a little bit, maybe in terms of their approach. They won't do that in Mumbai. They know exactly what they're going to be faced with. Maybe a bit of greenness, maybe not, but it's going to play like the Wankhede. And I think that that clarifies their selection in the way that James said about it, in terms of high pace bringing into the side, but also in terms of their batting approach. And that seems to have been the thing which has undone England a lot in this World Cup, is how hard do we go? We don't play much ODI cricket. We don't play at a domestic level. I'm not about to be that guy. I don't agree with that opinion. But I think there's a certain sense of predictability about cricket in Mumbai that will help England at the very least get back onto a, an even keel in terms of their approach. Whether it does in terms of their results, yeah, we'll have to wait and see.
All right, then. Well, plenty to look forward to next week with those two games standing out, I think, Australia-Pakistan and England-South Africa. We'll be back probably Monday or Tuesday next week, I reckon. A bit TBC, because obviously we're travelling a lot of days at the moment, Ben and I are anyway. So depending on schedules and stuff, we'll try and wrap up anything that's happened in the next round of games on one of those days. But we'll let you know. We'll tweet out the link to it as usual and give you plenty of notice. So yeah, join us then. Bye.